Today's Torah portion is Devarim, which begins in the Gutnik Chumash on page 1120. This class is given in memory of my father-in-law, Harav Gershom Ben Rav Ben-Zion, and his second Yahrzeit. His second Yahrzeit was just this past Shabbos, and I want to say this on the recording because I'd like this to be remembered. This past Shabbos in New York, a woman whose name was Rebbetzin Rishel Kotler. She passed away in New York. I think she was in her early 90s on the same day, the 2nd of Av. Now, the reason that I mention this is that it happens to be that in Japan, when my father-in-law was with the yeshivas that were there in Japan, the Lubavitch Yeshiva and also the Mir Yeshiva, so he spent a considerable amount of time, an effort, taking care of her health, and
getting her medicine,
all those kinds of things. And just to say it nicely, you know, if one couldn't take care of one's health, my father-in-law's brother passed away over there, just to give you some idea. And she is really a mother, grandmother, great-grandmother to a great dynasty in the world of Torah learning. And it's just interesting to me how, by divine providence, their yahrzeit is on the same day, the 2nd of Av. And this class is also given in memory of Blumi Pesel Bas of Pesach Halevi, and for the merit of a speedy recovery for Naomi Bas Bela Adis. And we're glad, finally, in the past classes, I gave the introduction, I said, Simi's not here, so the class will be as good as we can, but now Simi's here. Thank God we're going to have a normal class now.
What an intro. My mother will be coming, God willing, soon.
Yeah, Rachel wants to know, when? Your mother-in-law?
I remember a number of years ago, a relative of mine, well, actually it's a relative of a relative, well, like Yishmael would say, Mechutonim, sadly lost their daughter. Oh. And the sister of this girl was just inconsolable, as of course were the parents as well. But one of the things that really bothered her was she said that the last conversation with her sister, she said she didn't allow her to borrow her blow dryer. Like, that was the last conversation, you know? If we knew what our last conversation would be with people, what would it be? What would we want to say? If we had the opportunity to leave our last oral will and testament, our last words on this world, we would really think it through. And we would think of what type of message do we want to send to our family, to our children, to our friends. Well, this book of the Torah, Chumash Devarim, is actually Moshe's last will and testament. He's saying goodbye to the Jewish people. And it's amazing how, to me, it's just very emotional, actually, when you go through some of these parashiyot, where Moshe is basically saying goodbye to his family, to his children, to those that he cares about, those that he took care of as a shepherd. And he leaves them with his last words of advice. Some of it seems like admonishment, but all of it has a lesson. Some of it seems like he's just reviewing. In fact, this book of the Torah is called Mishneh Torah, like the concise double Torah. A lot of the stuff, oh yeah, we learned this already, we learned that already. He's reviewing. But he's reviewing because he wants to point out certain things and he wants to leave them with a lesson for life. So, you know that story that about the wealthy American businessman who went to China to, and he was giving a lecture in an organization that he supported. He had a translator. And he would speak for a while, he'd go on for a while, and then he'd stop, and the translator would say what he would say, and then he continued, and that's how they went back and forth. When he finished the lecture, he said to the translator, "That's really amazing. You seem to be able to really abbreviate whatever I said, and say it so concisely, and it went so smoothly. How did you do that?" He says, "I'll tell you the truth. When you finish each section," like a lot of times as he spoke, he told the guy, "No, continue, just keep going, and I'll do it." And then he did it very briefly. He says, "When you finished talking and I was translating, I basically told the people, wealthy man with checkbook said funny story. Do what you think is appropriate." So the people would laugh And then they would clap, finish, and he'd continue on. So why did I say this? Moshe, when he said this Mishneh Torah, he said it once, and then he repeated it again in another language. And then he repeated it again in another language. And then he went on again in another language. I mean, who was he talking to? Who was his audience? Right then and there, his audience was the Jewish people. He had been with them all these years. What was the language of the Jewish people?
Hebrew.
It was Lashon HaKodesh. That's one of the things we know, that the Jewish people did not change, even in the land of Egypt. So why on earth did he feel this need to repeat Mishneh Torah, to repeat his story, or to repeat his message over and over again to what they say is 70 languages, the 70 root languages? You know what it is?
He knew.
What did he know?
He knew that Hashem is going to disperse the Jewish people to all four corners of the world. Mm-hmm. So he knew, he's talking to the future, only not only to this generation, but generations to come.
Very good. So you should have given the class.
You've been around here a few years, it sounds like.
No, but it just makes sense.
Like right. The father who owned his deathbed, that he gives his children and admonishes them about the most important things in their lives, to keep watching for this and this and this.
Exactly. He was, and that included with what Ben just said, that Moshe knew. It's true, right now, these people may not speak Hochdeutsch, and they may not speak Swahili, but there's a future. And it should never be that the Jewish people, no matter what age they are, no matter what stage in their life they are, none of them should ever be able to say, well, that was, you know, that wandering nation in the desert, what did it have to do with me? He spoke in every language, literally and figuratively. He spoke in a language that any type of generation, no matter where they are, no matter what part of the world they are, they can say, Moshe was talking to me. He had a message that was eternal, that goes on, and it speaks to you, and it speaks to me, and what can I learn from it? And that's what we've been doing in these classes, is seeing, yes, some of it seems like, hey, what's this story? This story about what the Jewish people did with the spies. I have nothing to do with that. What do the Jewish people have to do with the golden calf? I have nothing to do with that. But every story that he reviews has a message for us. And that's why I'd like to go on to one of the stories that he points out in this parasha, where he talks about the story with the spies and how the Jewish people reacted. But before that, I just want to remind you of a story you might have heard for a while ago. So this guy is sitting with his wife, and they're in the car, they're traveling, and she says to him, you know, my dear husband, things have really changed between us over the years. Look at how we're sitting. You're sitting in your seat in the car. I'm sitting all the way in my seat by the window. Remember how it was 30 years ago when we got, just before we got married, you know, we used to sit so close together. I would sit so close, you'd have to be so careful with your driving. He turns to her and he says, listen, my dear, I've never moved. I've been sitting in this seat for 30 years, right? Take a look at yourself in the mirror, right? Mm. So
I was just thinking, you know, the Rebbe, how he send, like his word to that, he says, there's one Jew over there. Mm-hmm. Yes, one Jew. No, go over there. Remember the Rebbe said how every Jew is important?
Yeah, absolutely.
Every single Jew and in every single language. Yeah.
That's right. That's
exactly.
Right.
That's
exactly right. Yeah. Obviously, all relationships have their ups and downs. Even the most dynamic relationships have their ups and downs, because otherwise it would be a very smooth, boring road, right? Although some of us could settle for nice and smooth and nice and boring. But most relationships have their ups and downs. And Moshe Rabbeinu, as the life coach of the Jewish people, was going to point out some of the ups and some of the downs, definitely, in order, again, to teach the Jewish people profound lessons for the future. So as we said, one of the lessons he brings up in this parsha is he talks about the story with the spies and what happened. If you remember, with God's permission, Moses sent out the spies. They were great men, and we discussed this a number of weeks ago, why they came back with this evil report. They spread fear. There was pandemonium amongst the Jewish people. There was this paranoia that if we go there and we fight with them, it's basically a suicidal mission. We're just gonna blow up in our own faces because this is not something we can handle. They're too great for us. They're giants. They're scary. And we learned a few weeks ago. We discussed why on earth these great men would spread such pandemonium. It was really they had spiritual intentions, but it was wrong, right? Mm-hmm. They thought that it would be better to stay in a midbar, stay safe in their own little world and not deal with the outside world and not plow and sow and seed and do business and get involved in worldliness. They were scared the Jewish people would then forget to make time to learn Torah, to spend time with God. Okay, so we know that story. So Moshe brings up the story again, and when he brings it up, and we can look here on page 1131 in the English, he says, number 27. Joanne, do you mind reading it?
You spoke slanderously in your tents. You said, God took us out of the land of Egypt because he hates us. He wishes to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites and destroy us. Where shall we go? Our brothers have demoralized us, saying, we saw a people larger and taller than ourselves, than enormous cities fortified up to the heavens. And we have even seen giants there.
Okay. So he says, you have spoken slanderously in your tents and that you said God hates us. But I'm not going to ask you to go back to when the story actually happened in real life. But if we were to go back, we would see, we'd read the story. It never uses the words, God hates us. We never see in the original story that the Jews said, God hates us. So what is Moshe saying? What is he bringing up? Why is he bringing up this new element? Well, one of the first things, if we look closely again at the passage, was one of the first words you read, Joanne, was, you spoke slanderously in your tents. You know, it's one thing what you say out there in the street, but what are you whispering behind closed doors? And that's what he's saying. You were intimating, that was the connotation. You were saying God hates us, that he's going to do something like this to us. Now, Rashi speaks there and he says, what does it mean? I'm just going to read the Rashi in the Hebrew. I don't think we have the English here. V'hu haya ohev atchem, and God really loved you. Aval atem sonim oto, but you hated him. Mashal hedyot omer, ma debelibcha, arachamecha, ma delibeilech. I don't think I pronounced it.
He
has an English? Yes. Okay, Rashi says, he loved you, but you hated him, as is the common saying, what is in your heart about your beloved is in his heart about you. So Moshe is saying that is the nature of man, that we like to project our feelings on the other. Sometimes we're embarrassed to say that's the way I feel. I hate God. So you say, God hates us. The Jewish people were so angry, and they outwardly, consciously, so to speak, but not subconsciously, said, you know, we're really angry at God. But they wouldn't say, we hate God. They say, God hates us. You know, you project. That's the way I feel, so that's the way he must feel. He must feel that way, and therefore he is treating us this way. But the truth is that we think more about the Rashi, and the Rebbe discusses this, then Rashi is, something's really wrong here. Because in truth, it isn't so. It isn't so that the feeling of the other projects upon us, because, of course, God never hated us. So if the Jewish people were feeling angry with God, then really, if we say that the other person, if you go as a psychologist and you think it through, then that means that God should really be angry at the Jewish people. It's not so. But Moshe is really teaching us a lesson. If you go subconsciously, the Jewish people really always love God. And what he's saying is really, it's reflective. God always loves us. He always loves us no matter what. Sometimes there are actions, there are things that we see conscious on a conscious level. We see certain things in front of us. Like we don't have to go far back. We can go to any generation and we see Jewish people have been persecuted. And we could say, God hates us. What's he doing this for? He must hate us. But we know very well that internally we love God, God loves us. There's a reason. I was just recently listening to, actually last night, I was listening to a talk that Rebbetzin Kaplan from Israel gave here a number of years ago. And I just heard this one cute story, which has a very powerful lesson of herself with her little two-year-old. She said that she would wake up every morning, and no matter how young the kids were, as long as they could speak, she always taught them to say their prayers. The one prayer she really always insisted on was, Moda ani lefanecha, thanking God when we wake up in the morning, acknowledging that there's a God that takes care of everything, no matter what, whether it looks good or bad to us. And sometimes this particular, her youngest child, somehow the youngest child always manages. So this youngest one would, you know, speak up and, no, I don't want to. You know, all the other kids somehow, this is what we do, and the kid did it. And this, I see your smile, Tani, you understand what I'm talking about. This youngest child, somehow, he was like, yeah, I don't want to. So sometimes she would have this, ploy that she would use, and she would say, you don't want to have an angry mommy. And he would say it. So one morning he got up, and she said, okay, let's say Moda Ani. And the kid says, I want to have an angry mommy. I want to have an angry mommy. Now what's she going to do, right? And she's thinking, so she starts making her coffee, and she starts doing different things. And she decides, you know, she's just going to ignore him. I want to have an angry mommy. He's pulling on her skirt. I want to have an angry mommy. He wants to see what it's like. And she is just doing her thing and making an effort really not to look at him. She is a very conscientious effort not to look at him. And he keeps going. And then finally, she's ignoring him. So finally he says, okay, I'm going to say Moda Ani already, right? And he said the Moda Ani. And she thought about it afterwards, and she said, what happened here? He was feeling at that point, he was like, I can't take it. She must be so upset with me. She's ignoring me, right? But in truth, she said, what was happening at that time, her full focus was on him. She was so focused not to look at him. And that's really our relationship with God. There are times when we say, God must hate us. He's not even looking at us. He's not even focusing on us. Look at what he's letting happen, all these random events. That is the time when God is so focused on us. But it looks like he's not looking at us. And that's what happened here with the story of the spies or with other times. So Rashi's telling us that it's really a reflective. You think God hates you, but really, subconsciously, you love God, and you know God loves you. It's a reflective feeling. So just to round it off, so as we said, Moshe Rabbeinu is giving this as his last will and testament, his message to the Jewish people. And he felt that this is one of the stories that it's important to point out, because he wants Jewish people to know that throughout their lives, there's going to be times when we go through pain, when we go through challenges, and that if we know that God loves us no matter what, while we're going through that pain, if we know that there are times that it looks like he's ignoring us, just know that's when he's really focused on us. But for whatever reason it is, we have to go through this, but it's with his focused attention that appears as if he's ignoring us. And that helps us go through a lot of our hard times. If we know, like we've spoken, my husband has spoken many times about Rabbi Nissim Mengel, who went through, he was one of Mengele's experiments there in Auschwitz. But he is able to say today, I knew God is with me. And the same thing, I spoke recently in Colorado, and I spoke about how we survive and thrive as Jews, based on my father's story as a refugee through Shanghai, etc. And I think the main point, with all the history that I spoke about, the main point that I brought out was that how did we survive as Jews? Because that generation who went through the worst things, much worse than the challenges we go through today, they realized that when it looks like God's ignoring us, that's when he's with us most. It's like the Snapple jar. It says the best stuff is in here. God has the best stuff for us. He has the plan for us. It's uniquely designed for us, for each and every one of us. And if we keep in mind this lesson, that subconsciously there's always that love, and it's reflective. It's much easier. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier to go through the trials and the tribulations that we go through.
Yeah.
We try harder to kind of get into His presence.
Wow.
And through those times, He carries us even more profoundly.
So. Yeah.
That is really beautiful. No, let Joanne repeat it if you don't mind.
Yeah, just bring it a little closer and just repeat what you said. It needs to be recorded.
Okay. I was saying that it was interesting how the little boy, through that whole time that his mom was ignoring him, was so intent on getting his mother's attention. So that is so much like how we are. When we feel that heavens are closed off for us for some reason, we seek God even more diligently. And it's through those times that we really grow spiritually. I found that.
Yeah, totally. I relate to that 100%. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Wow. Amazing. Okay, we're on page 1134. And what I'd like to share with you is a thought about the pleasure of being a non-entity, which is completely contrary to the Western way of thinking, of course, because the Western way of thinking is supposedly you'll feel good if you are powerful, famous, and rich, of course, and so on. The pleasure of being a non-entity. I'd like to take you on a journey that begins after we will pose some questions in the text itself. We're going to go on a journey that begins with something that's complex. You'll have to sort of hold onto your brain to follow through. And then we will arrive at a place that is completely straightforward and simple. But only through this journey will we be able to walk away with an utterly profound and very personal message. So what we're going to talk about is something that is normally read and maybe not paid so much attention to. This talk is based upon the teachings of primarily the Alter Rebbe and our Rebbe in numerous places and also other areas in Chassidut. So let's take a look. We're now in chapter 5 and we're going to look at the second verse, Pasuk Bet. So can I ask you, Tani, can I ask you to read? And I'm going to just, from 2 until 5, okay?
What chapter 2?
Verse 2, this is page 1135. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. God spoke to me, saying, "You have circled this mountain long enough. Turn northward. Instruct the people, saying, 'You are about to pass by the border of your brothers, the children of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. Be very careful not to provoke them, because I will not give you any of their land, not even the right of passage without their permission, since I have given Mount Seir to Esau as an inheritance, and you can purchase food from..."
Okay, let's stop there for a second, sorry, because we're going to continue in verse 9 in just a moment. But what we're doing now is we're talking about three territories that the Jewish people were not going to inherit. And what we'll see after we go through those three is it seems contradictory to the promise that God made at the Bris Ben Absarim, when he told Abraham at the pact between the halves, as it's called, that he is going to give these territories. That's how we're going to start. So let's just read just verse 9 right now, because the first territory was the one that belonged to Esau or Seir. Go ahead.
"God said to me, 'Do not besiege Moab, and do not incite them to war, because I will not give you children of Lot as an inheritance.'" Yeah. "To the children of Lot as an inheritance."
Because, could you back up?
"You missed a line. I'll give you any."
Could you do it again, please? Yes.
Okay, sorry. "God said to me, 'Do not besiege Moab, and do not incite them to war, because I will not give you any of the land as an inheritance, since I have given the land of Moab, also known as to the children of Lot as an inheritance.'"
Okay, perfect. And now let's turn two pages forward to 1139 in the English, and it's going to be verse 37, is that right? Sorry, now we need to turn one more page, page 1141. And it's verse 37. Let's hear it. Go ahead.
Okay. The only places that you did not approach were the Amorite land. Ammonite land, the entire area bordering the river Yabok, and the cities of the mountain, and everywhere God, our God, commanded us not to conquer.
So therefore we have been told in these verses that the territory of Seir, Moab, and Ammon, we are not going to conquer. What we're going to do now is we're going to turn to the Torah portion of Bereshit, in chapter 15, verse 19. So now we're in the book of Bereshit, in the Gutnik Chumash, it's page 83. It's chapter 15, verse 18. So go ahead.
On that day, God struck a covenant with Avram, saying, I have given this land to your descendants. From the river of Egypt until the great river, the Euphrates River, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, and the Kadmonites, the Chittites, the Perizzites, the Raphaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites.
Okay, perfect. Now, if you count the actual number of territories here, you'll see that it mentions Canaanites, Kenizzites, and Kadmonites. That's who the territory belonged to at that time. Now, over the course of time, this is actually mentioned in our parsha in part, that over the course of time between then and the time that we're speaking now, of course, there were wars, which is generally, unfortunately, what history is made up of, and it became the territory of Seir, Moab, and Ammon, the very three territories that we said. So in other words, of 10 territories promised to Avram, the first three, we were told, now going into the land, that you're not going to get them. In other words, they're only going to get 7 out of 10. And how could this be? So, the way we study Torah is, we know that God's word is given to us on multiple levels. Every physical event on this world has a spiritual counterpart. To explain this, it can only be explained following the spiritual counterpart. And that is that the world was created with 10 utterances, and therefore every complete entity is made up of 10 elements. And I'll just give you a simple example. The human psyche is made up of 10 elements. There are 3 elements of intellect, and there are 6 emotions, and that makes it 9, and the 10th is the expression of those emotions, which is either speaking to ourselves, that's called thought, or speech, or action. So in very basic terms, originally what God is saying to Abraham is, you're going to inherit these lands, your descendants are going to inherit these lands, because they are going to repair all of these 10 elements, the 3 elements of intellect, and the 3, I'll call them all emotions, even though the last one is expressing them, the emotions. What happened in the end? Why are they not taking all 10? Because originally, when God said to Avram, I'm going to give you these lands, he's talking about giving them permanently. When God met Moshe on the burning bush, and you've heard this here before, but this is a central theme to Yiddishkeit, to Judaism, he said to Moshe, I'm going to take you out of Egypt, etc., 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 and he says, I'll bring you to the promised land. And when God said that, he meant that I will bring you there permanently. So what happened? What happened was, is we worshipped the golden calf. There were a couple of other things, like the spies, which we read about in today's Torah portion. So because of that rejection, God says, okay, so going in now, Moshe, you're not going to be able to go into the land, and this is something that we read about last week, and also we'll read about at the beginning of next week. Moshe could not go into the land because my original plan is that you were going to be the Mashiach. You're going to take it for them, and they will inherit it permanently. But because of their behavior, that is not going to be possible. As a matter of fact, in today's parsha, and I won't elaborate too much, it does say that God was angry with me because of you. Not because I hit the rock. Because of you. meaning to say, because you're not worthy of making this a permanent entry into the land, that is only going to be temporary, that after somewhat over 1,000 years, plus a few hundred years, you're going to be thrown out of this land, and only eventually will you come back to the land permanently with the coming of Mashiach. So for this reason, I'm giving you 7 territories out of 10. Now, why 7 out of 10? Why not 9 out of 10? Or 3 out of 10? Why? Because these 10 territories correspond to perfecting 7 emotions and perfecting our intellect. So now let's just speak on a more basic level, something that we can understand. We all understand that in order to improve our emotions and therefore our behavior, the 6 emotions and thought, speech, and action, our behavior, we do that by taking charge using our head. Meaning to say, we're born with this animal. You can call it evil inclination, you can call it any of those names, and you'll be right. Because that's really what it is. The way you take control of it is with something that is stronger than it, something that is above it, that's more powerful. And what is more powerful? It is the intellect. Because if I decide, if let's say, not I, somebody goes to the doctor, and I know somebody who the doctor said this to, if you do not lose weight, you are going to die. So he made a decision then and there, he's going to lose weight, and he shrunk to a third of his size, literally. Because we have something that's more powerful than the emotions, so we can therefore improve our emotions. Okay, that's understandable. How do we improve our intellect? We have to be able to reach something that is beyond our intellect. And we were not given that ability yet. That ability only comes in full with the coming of Mashiach. However, here is the good news. The good news is that in 1698, there was a boy born, and his name was Yisrael, and he became the Baal Shem Tov. And he brought the teachings of Hasidus to the world. And 2 generations later, there was the first Chabad Rebbe, Rebbe Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who took those very teachings to give them all of the intellectual imperatives and underpinnings that we learn over here and in any other Chabad house around the world, that which we have been studying for 7 generations.
Which because, comes from Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
Which is an introduction or a foretaste of the teachings in the time of Mashiach. Meaning to say, what I just told you was in different words, is that when the time of the coming of Mashiach, we're going to be able to improve our intellect. Today we have a little bit of that. And what I'd like to share with you is how you and I actually have it, and based on these teachings, we can completely alter the way we view the world, and some of this you already know from being here, but today I'm presenting it in a way that I believe you have not heard before in a much more profound way, and as I said at the outset, with profound practical implications that you can walk with right away. So let us explain this as follows. There is a verse in the prophets which says concerning the coming of Mashiach. It says these words, Torah chadosha me'iti teitze. A new Torah is going to come out from me. And then also in that prophecy, God says, I will make with you a bris chadosha, a new covenant. Now there are certain people who like to call it a New Testament, and this is what they base it on. But I don't want to talk about them. I want to talk about us, how we understand it. What is the meaning of a new covenant? The only way God could make a new covenant, it would seem, is if he retracts his word. What is his word? He made a promise to Abraham, and he repeated it to Isaac, and he repeated it to Jacob, and I'm paraphrasing, that your descendants are going to be my eternal people. That's what he said. So, the only way you can make a new covenant is if God somehow demonstrates that he lied. I don't believe in a God who lies. So what is the meaning of a new Torah and a new understanding. I would like to give an example from science. This is something which, in part, part of this you know, maybe all of it you know, but I think you will agree that this is an insight of something that every person on the planet experienced this world, but when we learned these things, we have a completely new perspective. So, let's just go back, let's say, a couple of hundred years ago, and we look at the world and we see all of the physical entities in the world, and we say, okay, wow, this is a cardboard box, this is paper, it has ink, and this is my flesh, and so on and so forth. Today, we look at the world completely differently because we know that it's really what we see is not what we really are. So let's just talk physical, pure science right now. So let's talk about ourselves. Who am I? What is my body? My body is made up of cells. Every living organism is made up of cells. Cells are made up of molecules. Molecules are made up of atoms. Now, atoms are made of subatomic particles. So here's the question. How much empty space is there in an atom? Because we know there's a nucleus, there's an electron, there's all sorts of whizzing activity happening over there. So there's got to be some space for that activity to happen. So I'm going to give you a rather long number. 99.99999999999999, I said that 13 nines, yeah? Percent of an atom is empty space. Yeah. Now, we are not even able to visualize what that means. So let's just think about it for a second. Before we go any further, before we even talk about subatomic particles, we're made up of atoms, of which 99.13 nines, there's nothing there. Right?
Some of us seem like
so,
you guys.
Right? So the thing is, so this is a perfect example when we understand this, because we look under the microscope and whatever equipment we use to look at these things, all of a sudden we have a brand new view of the same world we had all these years. This is what it means when it says, God says, I will give you a new Torah. You're going to look at the Torah and it's going to be, wow, I never saw it anywhere near this way. I mean, how many people would believe that this whole universe is primarily nothing? Physically, primarily. Now, of that 0.00000000000001, yeah? So let's put 12 zeros and then a 1. I said too many 1, right? Of that amount that there really is in the atom, it's made up of subatomic particles. Now, I'm not going to be too long-winded, but I'll just tell you, because I've mentioned this before, today we understand, based on quantum physics, that those subatomic particles are not even particles all the time. What do I mean? Particle means something that is either here or there. Cannot be in two places at once. If you have a wave, for example, a vibration, so let's say a drop in the water, so the waves go in all directions at once, right? When we do that wavy line, we're just doing a cross-section image of what the wave is. So a wave is a vibration, it's not really an entity. The water is water, and the wave is a wave. And what we understand now is that anything in the world, and this sounds strange, but it's true, anything in the world only begins to exist once human beings, not animals, once human beings look at it. Only when human beings look at it, then does what was heretofore a wave behave like a particle. Which means to say that what happens, let's say, at that distant galaxy, as long as nobody was looking at it through a telescope, scientifically we know it's true to say it wasn't there as a physical existence. So, therefore, we can ask the question, physically speaking, scientifically speaking, what are we really? And you might say, well, we are energy. Well, is energy physical? I think he'd be hard-pressed to call energy physical. So we're basically left with the question, what are we? Now, I use this example to give an example of the new Torah that it says in the prophets God is going to give us, and the new covenant, to point out that the way we see the world today is totally almost not related to the way we're going to see the Torah. But what I'd like to share with you now is that what I have just demonstrated on a very physical, scientific level is actually true spiritually as well. And what we're going to see is that we have a question. By the time we're finished, who are we, even spiritually? I'll ask you a very simple question. But before we do, I'm going to ask you to turn the page to next week's Torah portion of Va'et Hanan. I'm just going to look at a very little phrase that we say every single Shabbat before we say Vayhi B'Nisoah Ha'aron, before we take out the Torah from the Ark. And it is on page 1154, and in the English 1155. So that's Parashat Devarim, chapter 4, verse 30. Is that right? Verse 35. Chapter, I'm sorry, did I say chapter 3? I'm sorry. Chapter, is that right? Yeah.
1145?
Yeah, 11, it's chapter 4, yeah. Okay. Chapter 4, 1155. Okay. So here is what it says. It's talking in the previous passages, which you don't need to go there now because we're going to read it next week, about how you witnessed God's presence at the giving of the Torah in the presence of over 3 million of you. You saw God and you heard him utter the Ten Commandments. That's what it says in the previous page. And then it concludes by saying, Ata hareita ladat, you were shown, meaning when the Torah was given, so that you should know, Keshem olakim, that God is God. And listen to the next three words, Ein od milvado, there is none other beside him. Okay. So, I would like to say two things about this fact that there's none other besides God. If God is limited in any which way, I don't believe in him. You know why? Because if he's limited in any which way, there must be a power greater than God that is limiting him. How could I believe in a God that is limited in any which way? I can't. So, it makes sense that let's call it the first cause, if you want to use such a word, that the Creator, that God, has no limit. And if that's the case, how can this universe exist, or you and me exist, and God should exist separate from us? It cannot be. If God's existence is separate from our existence, this means there's a place that God isn't, namely, for example, me or this cup. And if God is thus limited, who's limiting him? I'd rather worship the one who's most powerful than he. So what does it say here? It says there's none other besides him. Meaning to say that the only existence is God. Now, incidentally, this idea is expressed in numerous ways throughout the Tanakh. But I'm mentioning this one because it happens to be next week's Torah portion, and we recite it every week before taking out the Torah. So how could it be that we're here and God is everywhere? But I'll ask you an even greater question, and to this we're going to turn the page to the very first page of the Chumash, which I believe in this Gutnik edition is page 2, as far as I know, after all the Roman numerals. And it happens to be, of course, chapter 1, verse 1 of book 1. And it says as follows. It says, Bereshis bara Elohim, in the beginning of God's creation, Esa Shemayim Ve'Esaretz, of the heavens and the earth. So the first thing that I see that God is saying, that God created something, not a figure, God didn't create an illusion. It says he created. Now, just in case you might want to argue that point, let's just go a little bit further to the next page, page 4 and page 5. Vayomer Elohim, God said, Yehi Or. He said, let there be light. What happened? Vayehi Or. And there was light. And with every utterance of creation, it says, he said, let there be, and there was. And I'll go even further. I'll jump ahead to page 14 and 15. It says as follows. It says in verse 4, Eile toldot hashamayim v'ha'aretz. This is the chronology of the heavens and earth. Behib oram, when he created them. Okay, so let's say you want to somehow twist the meaning of that word creation somehow. Beyom on the day, asot Hashem Elokim, that God made Eretz v'shamayim. Let's turn the page to page 16 and 17, verse number 6. And it says, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et ha'adam. God formed the man. Basically, what we're learning here is that God says, when I created this universe, I created a something, not an illusion. Now, I realize scientifically, the more we get into it, the harder it is to understand what is really existence. I understand that physically. I'm saying spiritually, it is, we have even more the same issue, because scientifically we know what we know. Maybe we'll find out tomorrow something else. But spiritually speaking, it says in today's parasha, in next week's parasha, there's none other beside him. So how could we exist? Now it must be that we do, that it is some form of existence. It must be in some form. Why? Because God says that I made this existence, this creation called heaven, the earth. So I'd like to explain it to you this way, by way of a few analogies. So let's assume for a minute that you have something that I have here in the kitchen. We have a stove that behind it is a big window, and a certain time of day the sun shines right through it. So we can turn on a big flame and you literally do not see the flame. Obviously, if you put your hand there, it's going to hurt. And if you put a pot on there with food in it, it is going to cook. So in other words, it's the fire is there, but it's, how should we say it, absorbed into the light of the sun. I don't know which other word to use, but I'll use that word. So let us consider now the world in which we live. In other words, who am I? Remember what the heading is, the pleasure of being a non-entity. So we haven't come to the pleasure yet, which we're going to get to, but we are on the subject where we're getting closer to seeing ourselves as non-entities. The question is, who are we really? So the truth of the matter is that just like when we look with our knowledge today at what is the essence of existence as we can perceive it, I'm going to use this word. We basically see energy. I don't have a better word to say. Energy is kind of a definable and non-definable word at the same time. Because anything that can alternate between a vibration and being a particle means that in essence, it isn't a particle. In essence, it isn't. Why? Because it alternates between a particle, which means in English a something, and between a non-something, just a energy, really. A vibration is really energy. All right. So now, this energy has to be rooted somewhere. So before we continue on that journey, let's just think about something that we're all in agreement about. We know that we're living. How do we know? We could move, we can think, and we can feel. So now, if I put a plate on the table and said, could you take some of this substance that you call life and put it on the plate? Obviously you couldn't. Can you take some of this substance called intellect or even visualization and put it on the plate? You could not. And feelings. I know what feelings do and the result of feelings, but the feeling in itself. Can you take that feeling, put it on the plate? You cannot. In other words, we all experience something that is spiritual and is not physical. We know that it's there because we're experiencing it. In the very same way, we can understand that the energy that makes up this world is rooted in something that is, I'll call it, deeper, more powerful than the energy itself. Why? Because every effect has to have a cause. The cause is always greater than the effect. So therefore, whatever this energy of existence is, must come from a source of energy. And where is this source of energy? You keep going backwards to the source of the source of the source of the source, and you'll go on forever unless you make one, unless you recognize one truth, and that is that there must be a first cause. You want to call it the energy of all energies, you want to call it intelligence of all intelligence, it doesn't make a difference what you call it. There must be an infinite first cause. Now, when this infinite first cause decides that an expression or projection of himself, and I don't have another word with which to say it, but he decides that he's going to project himself in a certain manner, then this expression or extension of himself is real because he is real. Meaning to say, we ask the question. Physically, when we look at ourselves, we become more and more nothingness the more we understand the physical reality. And we look at the spiritual reality and we say, how can there be anything outside of God? And the only answer is, and this is elaborated upon in great detail in the, I believe it's 12 chapters of the second part of the book of the Tanya. It's called Shara Yichud Ve'emunah. And I'm just giving you a squeezed essence from there, that really this world exists in the way it does, even though it's everything is only godliness. But the reason that we experience it this way is because that is how God decided that an extension of himself should be experienced in this way. So what do we have as a result of all of this? What we have as a result is that the person I thought I was before this class or before understanding these things completely doesn't exist. Just like the people, what people thought before quantum mechanics, before being able to recognize atoms and subatomic particles and how much 99.99 × 13 of emptiness there is in all the atoms, they had a view of the world as existence as it is. We now have a new, brand new view that eliminates basically our view of the world, even scientifically. Just like it says, when the Mashiach is going to come, what does the prophet say? I'm going to give you a new Torah and a new covenant. How could God be a liar? God made a covenant to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now he's going to cancel it and make a new one? I don't like to believe in a God who is a liar. No! God is simply going to open up our understanding. I'm going to say, wow, I never understood that this is really the world we live in. That I hold this box of tissues, and you know what I'm holding? All I'm holding is an expression of God. That's what it is. Now, with that in mind, we understand the following. Everything in this universe is just an extension of God. If that's the case, you may say, what's the difference between me and a tree? Or between me and a stone? I'll tell you the difference. The only difference is the level of divine expression. There's divine expression in a stone that is in such a manner that the stone gets washed around, blown around, kicked around. But the stone, it doesn't animate, it doesn't grow. There's divine expression in vegetation. So the vegetation is going to grow. We see more of a divine expression. How come? Because we see that the vegetation continues to grow. And even more, we have, and I've mentioned this before, but it's worth mentioning right at this point, we have in anything that is animate, vegetation, any form of life, we really have an expression of the God's infinitude. You know how? Because the life that gets passed on when, let's say, a plant is pollinated and now it reproduces, and you go 1,000 generations later, 10,000 generations later, whatever it happens, the species happens to be, the life energy is not less or more. It's identical. So, for example, they found in Israel some pits of a date that is 2,000 years old, and now they began cultivating and growing it. What is the life energy level of that date and any date that has been grown all these years? Identical. So in other words, everything in this universe ebbs and goes away, except for one thing, the life energy that goes through the generations without changing. The same thing, obviously, is with animals and with people. So my point is that the difference between a stone and vegetation is that God's the expression of himself through vegetation is more apparent in vegetation than in a stone. But now when you get to animals, it's even more apparent. Why? Because they have another non-tangible. They have, besides mobility, animals have feelings. Now, they cannot control with their intellect. I mean, that cow is never going to decide to smoke cigarettes. And that lion is not going to decide to eat blueberries. It's just not going to do that. But they do have feelings. That's, again, a higher level of intangible. And then we get to human beings. Human beings, where God's expression is more apparent because we're given intellect. God says, let me make man in our image. And as we just read on this page, page 16, and it says, in the second top line, Vayipach ba'af of nishmas chaim, he blew into his nostrils a living soul. And it goes on to say, and I won't make us turn the pages now, where he says about making a man in God's image. What's the meaning of God's image? Just like God has the freedom to choose, nothing can get in his way, we're also given the ability to choose and override all influences, which means we can choose to smoke cigarettes, we can choose to do other dangerous and silly things, and we can choose to, let's say, come up with an idea of how to save people. Like, we'll invent plastic, which some people hate. But because of plastic, we're going to keep food edible so that millions of people will not die of starvation. Right? We're given that freedom to choose. So now that we understand this, the Jewish soul has yet a more exposed level of the divine energy. God says, this is my eternal people. He said that to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When we read the covenant, the pact between the halves, that's when he said it to Abram. This is going to be my people, and so on and so forth. I'm going to give them these 10 territories, and that's going to be in the time of the coming of Mashiach. So what have we learned here? We've learned here that this teaching that I just shared with you, which is from, this is really Chassidut, the foundation of Chassidut. There's 12 chapters, as I said, in volume 2 of Tanya, which explains all of this in great length, is giving us a foretaste of how we're going to view the world with the coming of Mashiach. Meaning to say, with the coming of Mashiach, everything that we look at, we're going to see the godliness right away. That's how we're going to, that will be our world perspective, a brand new world. Now we understand a new Torah, a new covenant, brand new. But today, we can choose to at least intellectually comprehend it. We can perfect our intellect now. So how does all of this come to something very, very practical? Because I asked a question not too long ago, saying, if everything is just an expression of divine energy, what's the difference between me and a stone? And I explained how there's different expressions of divine energy. What is the difference between the divine expression between, let's say, a Jewish person here in White Rock, South Surrey, and let's say a person who's in the Congo? What's the difference in the divine expression? And the answer is there isn't. Because every Jewish person on this planet comes from a singular expression of divine projection. And I'm using those words because I don't have any other words. We call it the root soul of the Jewish people. All of a sudden, when we understand that, what do we understand? Who am I as a separate entity? Actually, I'm not a separate entity. So now, if I meet this Jew from the Congo, me and him are really one. We're really one. That is the truth. Now, how can I, number one, be irritated by part of myself? I realize that my toe can bother me and I can't sleep at night because of it. I'm not going to take a knife and cut off the toe. I'm going to try and go to the doctor and get it healed. So another person can try and irritate me. But really, the real truth is, him irritating me is like my toe irritating me, or my left hand irritating the right hand, etc. So what we understand is that there's a great pleasure of realizing how much of a non-entity we really are, because through it we realize we're really all one. And that if a person, let's say, tries to step on me, the hurt is really superficial. Now, I know it's hard to feel that way, but when we understand this, remember, we're only beginning to experience the perfection of intellect, those three territories that were not given in today's parsha that we started out with. But we're beginning to get it now because we realize that we can ponder it deeply enough and come to that recognition, and we can let go. Now, some people say let go because it's healthier. You can say let go because it makes you feel good. And I won't knock that. But what Chassidus teaches us, let go because it's the truth.
But did he corrupt the three territories? Let me just finish.
He said not yet.
Like you talking.
This is exactly the point. He says, for example, I'm giving this to the people of Seir.
Exactly.
When we say Oz Yashir, the very end is the prophecy of the time of Mashiach is that we're going to inherit the possession of Esav. So it's not cut off completely. He says you're not going to take it now, but you are going to get it later on. Because remember, if it's totally cut off, it means you lied to Abraham.
But you know, today, for example,
the whole point is when Mashiach comes, we will own all these 10 territories. That is precisely the point.
But when Mashiach comes, it could be another 10,000 years. What I'm saying here, meanwhile we're suffering. We the Jewish people.
Guess what? Meanwhile we're in exile. Of course we're suffering meanwhile. That's the whole thing. That's why we say we want Mashiach now, because in English the word want means we're lacking. That is the point. So, yes. So here is an analogy, right? There are two twins in a womb, and they hear these noises from outside the wall of the womb. And one of them says, you know, I think that there's really a world beyond this world. The other one says, nah, what are you talking about? We're living here in paradise. We get fed automatically through the umbilical cord. We live in this wonderful warm fluid. And everything is just perfect. There's not... Nah, he says, I think there's something on the other end. But then what starts happening all of a sudden, there's this tremendous turmoil and squeezing. As a matter of fact, the water begins leaking out. And they're wondering, like, what's happening all of a sudden? And then one of them gets squeezed so tight. I mean, his head becomes like a football, you know. And finally comes out the other end. And he's crying, but everybody says, Mazel Tov! And the one who's still inside says, Oi! Is this world coming to an end? Armageddon, some people like to say. I don't know exactly what that means. But they say that. But then again, he himself also, he's going through that. He's being totally squeezed, another football head. And then we say Mazel Tov. And that's really the way it is. We live in a world now, and I also like this because this dovetails with what Simi said earlier. And you also mentioned so beautifully how she says, I was concentrating on my child by staying away, you know, by not turning on him. My mind was on him all the time. And here you said that when we see that concealment, we turn to God. And this is exactly the point. We are approaching the coming of Mashiach. So yes, we're really in the birth canal. And we're about to come out at the other end. But the more we understand how everything is a divine projection, it becomes easier to say, for example, when something happens and a person says, God has a plan, I say to you that's 100% correct. But when we understand that there is nothing else besides God, and the only way we know that we exist and we're not a mirage is because God says you are in existence, you are in a projection of myself, so then it's not just God has a plan. There's nothing else besides God. So it doesn't mean that the squeezing in the birth canal doesn't hurt, but it means not only do we know there's a good outcome, but we know there's nothing else besides God. It becomes easier. And one more thing, and I think I'll close with this. Our biggest enemy, and I've said this before, our biggest enemy is our ego. If we get angry, it's our ego. If we're hurt by people, it's our ego. Everything about us, it's our ego. And I want to repeat something that, even though I said this a couple of weeks ago, you remember there was this court case about this Nazi, who's 93 years old, and one woman, a survivor, went and he said, I forgive you. Now, at the outset, let me say, I have no judgment for any Holocaust survivor of any of their behaviors. I want to repeat something that she said, which I thought was really profound. And she said, and you can look this up on YouTube, you could hear her say it in a few interviews. She said, why do I have to still have this hate? I want to be able to live with myself. I want to be able to live. In other words, she found that her hate for those people who did what they did to her, and she was a twin, you know, with Mengele, the whole bit. And as she said, that they did experiments on her, and the twin was the control group, I guess. And she knew that the minute something would happen wrong with her, then her sister would die, and they'd quickly open up and open her up and make the comparisons. So, I mean, this is somebody who's really been through, the ringer. Why should I have to live with hate? The thing is, it's true that it is easier for a person to live when they let go, even on that level. It is closer to the truth to add on top of that, not to replace it, but to add on top of that, there's only God in the world. If there's only God in the world, what's this business about me bearing a grudge as if I am something separate from God's plan? As if I'm something separate from God's plan. And this is how the Alter Rebbe explains anger. Our sages have a strange comment. They say, whoever gets angry is like you worshipping idols. Now, what is the relationship between worshipping idols and anger? So he says, all there is God, and everything in the world is a projection of God. So let's say somebody comes up to you in public and begins, let's say, criticizing your mother in front of other people, and you're really, like, you're about to explode. So the fact that the person chose to be an agent of such activity, that's their freedom of choice. They have to make an accounting with God. But the fact that I have to be in this situation, this world is nothing but a projection of God. So who is the me to be angry? The question of who am I, that really the I is a non-entity, it's only a projection of God, is on the one hand both sophisticated as complex as we've explained it, but it's also a simple truth that allows us to live in harmony with the truth of God's existence, and therefore troubles of this world don't have to overwhelm us the way they do.
But this is why they're saying, how could God let the...
The question is, how many souls were there at Mount Sinai? The real answer is, there's one root soul, which has 600,000 expressions. Each of those expressions is subdivided by subcategories, which are explicitly listed in the book of Tanya. In Tanya, and every single one of them were all present at Har Sinai. Every single one of them.